Hello, and welcome to Beverage Industry Sip and Learn podcasting series. I'm your host, Barbara Harfman, managing editor of Beverage Industry Magazine. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Bill Oliver, the co-founder of Oliver Winery and Vineyards in Bloomington, Indiana, which in 2017 was ranked by Travel and Leisure magazine as one of the top 25 wineries to visit in the United States. It is well known for its very sippable fruit-forward wines, such as Blueberry Moscato, Cherry Moscato, and its newest wine, Lemon Moscato. Thank you so much for joining me today, Bill.
It's great to be here, Barbara. Looking forward to it.
So my husband and I had the chance to visit Oliver Winery in late May, and we loved seeing all the beautiful flowers on the grounds, picnic tables inviting visitors to sit down and relax, and of course, tasting some of your more than 40 varieties of wine. Explain to the folks who haven't visited your namesake winery how the ambiance of the grounds, the tasting, and the overall experience of visiting the winery is centered upon the mantra of hospitality in the heartland.
Yeah, you know, it's what became apparent to me as a young consumer of wines, and I think that that's kind of where my strengths come from, is that I like wine. I drink a lot of wine. I like to visit wineries. And I think if you don't possess those qualities, you probably can't get very far in this industry. But I was just really struck by what I saw in the West Coast, you know, going to the Napa Valley back in the 80s. I was just, wow, this is amazing. And it was obvious that people were going there not because they needed a bottle of wine. They wanted the experience, right? So they went, so we're going to do, we're going to kind of import that kind of a characteristic back to Bloomington, Indiana, and really just treat people awesome when they walk in the front door, in addition to having, you know, beautiful grounds and, you know, a place where you can spend some time, go on a tour, taste wines, have a picnic, and hopefully leave with some wine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because now the winery is nearly 50 years old. I hope that doesn't date you too much, Bill, but it was founded by your dad in 1972. And originally, obviously, he just planted a few acres. But your on-site vineyard operations has now grown to 54 acres. And it sits on limestone bedrock, which makes the soil ideally suited for growing grapes. So all told, how many different varieties of grapes do you grow? And answer that first. How many different varieties?
We grow six, and we've actually reduced it over time because I think in the early days, it was like, let's plant a lot of things and figure out what works. I think the corollary to that question is figure out what doesn't work, right? And so when things don't work, we're not very patient with them. And that could either be from a climatic viticultural point of view, or perhaps the wines just aren't working in the tasting room. You know, if people aren't buying it, then there's no point in growing the grapes. So we're down to six, and interspecific hybrids, primarily a little bit of Labrusca, that'd be Catawba. And we grow Catawba very, very well.
Okay. And then I'm also interested in hearing about the rare hybrid grapes that you guys are growing. If I'm not butchering the name, a Cabernet Doré and Crimson Cabernet. So what wines feature these particular grapes, and how are they setting a new standard for kind of uncommon wines?
Well, I mean, those are relatively new hybrids that are Crimson Cabernet is Norton, which is Missouri's grape, right? And they're really the flagship grape there, and crossed with Cabernet Sauvignon. And so it's sort of, I think intuitively, it makes sense that we could combine a grape with proven kind of hardiness and decent winemaking quality. That'd be Norton with Cabernet Sauvignon, which needs no explanation at all that you would get, you might get a good result from it. You know, you never know in grape hybridizing what you're going to get. So you just got to keep trying. It's proven to be the case. It really makes a nice wine that's really, really sturdy in our somewhat challenging climate. It makes a beautiful wine.
And how does the fact that we haven't had a lot of rain recently impacting the growing of your grapes?
Oh, less rain is better, always.
Really?
I've never had a growing season here that I wish that it was wetter. So for us, if you think about the classic growing areas of the world, and just for instance, you know, California and maybe Eastern Washington State, they're just basically irrigated deserts in the summertime. I mean, and I would like always point out that Napa, for instance, gets about the same amount of rain as we do annually. They get about 40, 45 inches, but it all falls between like November and April. ours falls every single month, right? Rain. There's about 3 to 3.5 inches maybe rain every month, you know, whether or not you want it. So we like dry summers. We really do. And our, you know, back to the soil comment was on these Kreider soils on top of fractured limestone. It's about, I'd say, a foot to maybe 2 feet of a more of a loamy classic topsoil on top of clay. And clay is an outstanding subsoil for grapevines because the roots go deep into the clay and the clay holds moisture over the summer, right? So even during a protracted dry spell, you know, grapes that are grown on clay do very, very well.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So this year, the winery is anticipating sales of 900,000 cases, which obviously is a huge increase over the 25,000 cases that you produced in 1996. To meet capacity, the winery is adding some exciting new equipment. You are adding a new sensory analysis and lab space and a new primary bottling line that's going to triple on-site bottling capacity. And then in 2016, these three huge 114,000-gallon stainless tanks were also added to the facility. So tell me about your production capacity and why the winery is investing basically million-dollar capital to grow its business while also maintaining the quality standards that you're known for.
You know, we've been very concerned with growing at a healthy rate. And it goes back to your quality point of view. We really just want to get too far ahead of ourselves on being able to manage the growth and make sure that the wines were always great. I mean, because nothing can put a stop to growth and, you know, suddenly going from a producer of great wines to not so great wines. So that's always been the first and foremost. But, you know, a lot of our equipment has been in large volume equipment. And, you know, what we've figured out over the years is that we make wine in bigger tanks. We make better wine. And because the opportunity for oxidation is greater in small batch wines. It really is. Because there's, you know, relatively less volume of wine for every sort of kind of injury you can give to the wine. For instance, you know, if you filter wine, maybe a fixed amount of oxygen to get into the wine, any kind of racking and stuff. We've really found that we have better quality control in larger tanks. And plus, we're just making big batches of wine. You know, definitely Apple products, Moscato products, Concord products, you know, we do 70, 80,000 gallon fermentations. And it's way better to have one big tank than five or more smaller tanks just from managing the project.
So one of the things that Oliver Winery prides itself on is, although, you know, I like sweet wines, but you actually create wines for every palate. You know, you've got the semi-sweet, the semi-dry, the dry whites, the dry reds, and the dessert and sparkling wines. You are currently serving kind of as a board member. So, but when you were more, and maybe you are still hands-on in terms of winemaking and overseeing operations. How long were you actually involved in actual winemaking and overseeing operations before you sort of took a step back?
Well, my role as winemaker, as a Card King winemaker, started 1993, okay. So quite a while ago. But the end date was less obvious, right? Because I just became more and more engaged in more of the business management part of the operation as it grew, and other people kind of backfilled, you know, behind me, like Dennis Dunham, who's our winemaker now. So I can't really give you the end date; it's not quite so obvious, but you know, a good 20 years, I would say. And you know, I think that's the strength as a winery owner is that I came from winemaking. You know, that's kind of where my love was, and that really drove kind of our business philosophy. It was winemaking first, versus let's just say I was from a marketing or finance background. I think that kind of business, an owner from those backgrounds would be run in a different way than an owner that comes from winemaking.
And you also, you inherited that from your father because he obviously was the one that founded the winery back in 1972. What did you learn from working alongside him about the art and science of winemaking?
Well, you know, he was a law professor during the time that he was, you know, quote unquote, running the winery. And that presented, you know, challenges, honestly, because we had an on-site winemaking crew and some managers that where the owner wasn't there much. And so that was, I think, probably the biggest thing I learned is if you want it to be done right, you got to show up and be there. And so I guess, you know, that the owner's presence is the most important thing. No disrespect to him, but that was the reality of where he was. And I've seen that with other, you know, small winery startup, you know, a friend that had a really nice full-time job and was also starting a winery, and he really needed the full-time job to pay the winery's bills. And yet he couldn't run the winery effectively with the job that he had. So, you know, and there's no right answer to this question. When do you leave your employment, go all in on your winery, and sure as just hope it works, right? It's a big gamble.
Well, it looks like the gamble that your dad and you have made has certainly paid off. But when you were more hands-on, was there a certain wine style that you created that you were particularly proud of? I mean, I'm not sure. I heard the phrase soft red, and I'm wondering who coined that and what that actually means, because it's something that Oliver Winery is kind of famous for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of all of them. I mean, I'm, you know, at heart, I'm a dry wine drinker. That's what you'll find in my house, and I love those wines. But you know, the reality for a winery in Indiana is that we're not going to become a national Cabernet Sauvignon brand. It's just is not going to happen. And you know, as people's, I would say, there has been a greater openness to sweet wines, especially in maybe the last two decades, that we've been able to capitalize on. And so that's our opportunity. That's our opportunity to grow there. Soft Red was the early one that goes back to the 80s. I mean, that wasn't, you know, I wouldn't call that, you know, from the mind of a, you know, freshly graduated, you know, college student. It wasn't any sort of stroke of, you know, marketing genius to call it Soft Red, but I just think it implied that it was easy to drink, you know, and we drifted away from that name. You know, it's called, you know, our sweet red now, because it wasn't obvious to people who were looking at a bottle that said Soft Red that it was a sweet red. So we just basically just kind of hands up and said, all right, we're going to call it Sweet Red, you know, from this point on. And that happened, oh, I'd say that was maybe 18 months ago. And it was a good move. It felt risky to us, because it was such a large part of our business and is a large part of our business to make a kind of a labeling change like that. But, it worked, and we continue to sell a tremendous amount of that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look back on the past 50 years, you know, it's really hard probably to put into words, what resonates is really special as far as Oliver Winery and Vineyards, but can you do that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's a bit of a cliche to say, and businesses say this all the time, that our biggest strength is our people, mm-hmm. but it certainly is with us. And we could not have taken the winery where it is today without a core group of really dedicated, super smart, hardworking people. You know, Dennis Dunham, Julie Adams, Chris Hebert, you know, you can just go down the list of people that without them, it would not have been possible. And that's kind of the story behind the story is, you know, by, I guess, you know, hard work and some failures and some successes, we've just managed to put together a great bunch of people who just believe in what we're doing and are all in.
Yeah, very, very important. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add or stress that I haven't covered that you want to make sure people know about?
You know, I would like to say that, you know, this goes back to the people too. My own perspective is that the whole endeavor, and not every single moment of it, but for the most part, has been a huge amount of fun and a great creative outlet. And we've laughed our heads off so much at times and just had just fun doing it, because it's an amazing industry, right? This is a fantastic way to make a living. And I think that has been a critical element of our success, is that we've just had fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, that my husband and I certainly had fun when we were there. We had a lot of fun after I had my fifth glass. Yeah,
I'm coming. Right? We're doing that balloon flight. That's what we're doing, right?
Oh, we're going to do it. Yes. Yep. So I really thank you so much for your time today, Bill. And I appreciated really learning more about what sets your winery and your team and vineyard in the heart of the heartland apart from the rest. Continued success to you and your team of now 100 employees. And for more about the latest innovations hitting the beverage market, be sure to check back with Beverage Industry Magazine's Sip and Learn podcasting series. Thank you.